I was a school teacher for 1 year, is off the record. And I did have hay fever, and I went to the school one time with the hay fever, and I started sniffing like that. And then the next time I looked up, the 30 children, 13, 14 year olds, were all looking at me going, they could be so cruel. And to see if any one of you can guess this. When I was a school teacher, of course, you always give school teachers nicknames. So I had a nickname, which I found out at the end of the year. So if anyone can guess my nickname when I was a school teacher, you can have an extra interview. No, I know, you may know, but so shh. Anyway, so we're back to the talk for this morning. So, where was I going last time with the... sound, yeah. So, with the Anapanasati, with the mindfulness, yesterday was just emphasizing the preparations. And so we get the, in the present moment, the silence, really building up something which is important as a background for meditation. Doing that preparation, I always mentioned, was important. And then, how does the meditation happen? How do we actually become aware of something like the breathing? And you know, I mentioned yesterday that it's a natural process, no effort required, except to restrain, to stop things, stop interfering. How does that work? Now, I understand that sometimes people think, this doesn't make any sense. Because it was a trouble for me, because my teacher, Ajahn Chah, would always give these similes, and which was like, you know, just relax, stop it. And one of his most important similes was one which I heard in the first couple of months when I was staying, when I went to be his disciple, the first year I was a monk. And the simile he gave, and the similes which he would deliver to people, he would actually, because he saw many, many different people, he gave it to this person, that person, and so for a week he would do the same simile. And then it would develop to another simile. And then he would forget that early simile. And I never heard him say this simile again. Only the first month, I think, I was at Wat Pa Phong. And that was the simile of the mango orchard. And I forgot that simile for many years. And the reason I forgot it was it sounded like nonsense to me. It never made any sense whatsoever. But it was later on, when your meditation started to develop, you realize, whoa, that was an amazing description of how the deep meditations, the insights, enlightenment actually happened. And the simile of the mango grove went like this. He would say that his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, was a mango orchard. Mistake number one, not a mango orchard, it was a forest. He said those mango trees were planted by the Buddha. That was 2,500 years ago. No mango tree will survive that long. Anyway, the Buddha didn't plant mango trees, he planted Dhamma. And he said, now those mango trees are full of delicious, sweet mangoes. And we're eating frogs and rice in those days. Where were those mangoes? I want one. There weren't any. And also, when there were mangoes, they were seasonal, usually towards the end of the hot season, or actually just middle of the hot season in northeast Thailand, around April, May. And he said, the weirdest thing, to get one of those mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha, you cannot climb that tree. It's impossible. You shake the tree, the mango will never fall. You throw a stick up at the tree to hit the mangoes, you'd always miss. Those were the main ways to get the mangoes from those trees. These days, you would say, if you get a ladder, you won't be able to reach the mangoes. You get a cherry picker, you will not be able to get those mangoes. You get a drone, and you won't be able to reach those mangoes. He said, there's only one way in the world, to get those mangoes, the sweet, juiciest mangoes planted by the Buddha. And he said, that is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Hold out your hand, and a mango will fall. Well, absolute nonsense, I thought. Because, you know, I'd know mango trees. And maybe that was a simile, because there's no mango trees in England. There were apple trees. Isaac Newton. He was sitting under the apple tree and an apple fell down and he got the law of gravity. You see, so there's some truth to this. Wisdom coming. But for the trees planted by the Buddha, that made no sense at all. How long would you have to wait if you put a hand out? Sitting absolutely still, you mean doing nothing? Yes, said Ajahn Chah. So because it made no sense, I forgot about it. And of course, later on, some of the teachings which people say, we think we reject it, it makes no sense. But somehow or other, it stays like a seed, like in the desert. And when the rain falls, you know, which it does from time to time, maybe after a few years, then all those seeds germinate and you get this beautiful mass of flowers in the middle of arid deserts when the rain actually comes. The seeds are almost designed to withstand years of drought, so when the rain comes, they can flower. And that's with some of the Dhamma teachings. Many of the things which even you hear here on this retreat, you will think make no sense. You will reject it, but it will stay in your mind somewhere. Especially teachings on meditation. Stay in your mind until the right time, and then they will bear fruit. Many times when I was meditating, and then I got a great insight. I said, oh, let's do it this way. And it worked. And I said, where did that come from? Ajahn Chah taught me that, and I'd forgot about it for years. And I realized just how some of the deepest of teachings you may just not understand or reject or think is outright craziness. But they do lodge somewhere in your mind, not in your brain, in your mind, waiting for the right time. But anyway, what did it mean? Sitting under the mango tree, holding out your hand. How long do I have to wait? Oh, just a very short time. Why would it actually fall right into my hand? And because knowing my luck, be on my head. And when they're ripe anyway, those mangoes, especially the ones I knew in Thailand, they would always be eaten by the birds first. And, you know, you'd have to try and get them down. Waiting them to fall, they'd be eaten by that time. So, what did it mean? There came times when you work so hard, you really tried to get your meditation together, sat for long periods, endured pain, really worked and just thought of everything you could to try and get deep into meditation. And what happened? Nothing. So there comes a time when you give up, when you let go. And there's so many wonderful stories, even in my lifetime, of just people who, oh, they put so much effort into their meditations. They're really trying hard. I already mentioned one of those people, that gentleman with the sinus cancer. 9 days, getting nowhere, the last meditation. Or there's another bhikkhuni, I can't tell her name. But she was on one of my retreats, one of the executive retreats, I think in, not Phuket, was the other place up in Khao Lak, yeah. And she was very diligent, meditating and meditating, getting nowhere. You know, just like some of you think, what do I have to do to get deep meditation? But she was getting nowhere. And then at the end of the retreat, once we did the final ceremonies, she'd already arranged a taxi to the airport, but she had, what she told me, an hour to kill. Nothing to do. So what do you do? Well, I might as well meditate. Nothing else to do. So that was the first time in the retreat she wasn't trying to achieve anything. She was just killing time. And I always remember when she came up afterwards, just before the taxi took her away to the airport. I was, I think, having a cup of tea or something, sitting on a chair, and she came up to me on the floor, kneeling with her hands up. And just the only way I can describe it is like if you have a son or a daughter and they've just fallen in love. Oh, daddy, daddy. Oh, he's a wonderful, mighty boy. That's what she was gushing. It was, so wonderful. Oh, thank you so much. Oh. I'm not a good actor, I must admit. But, I mean, that's what she was actually saying. And the main point was that once she stopped trying, then that's what happened. And I think, I'm not sure if I think I mentioned this in an interview. And I, at this point, we have the caretaker there, Scotty. He's outside. Okay, please, Scotty, make sure that you lock away all the pieces of rope this afternoon. Because this one's from the Terigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns, the bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha. They were there from the very start and they're amazing. But this nun, bhikkhuni, 7 years she'd been meditating, 7 years of disappointment and frustration. And so, in her poem, of enlightenment poem, she was saying after 7 years she'd had enough. But she didn't want to go back to being a laywoman. In those days, it was going back to what she called the three crooked things. And the first crooked thing, this was just the idioms of Pali at that time. The first crooked thing was the soup ladle. It was the simile of housework. The second crooked thing was the floor brush. She didn't want to go back to cooking, she didn't want to go back to housework. And she didn't want to go back to the third crooked thing, the husband. I have a sense of humour in those days as well, but she had enough of all of that. So what could she do? She couldn't go back to the home life, house life. She couldn't meditate anymore, she tried everything. And this is why you should not do this, okay? This was just very lucky. I'll get sued if somebody follows this one, it doesn't work. So she took the length of rope and went to the forest. She climbed a tree. She tied one end of the rope to a strong bough, a strong branch, and the other one around her neck. And she was just about to jump off when she got it. A great achievement. It's a very weird way of getting enlightened. And it's not one which I would recommend and teach. But why did that happen? Why? And it was because, you know, she had all the gifts there. She was trying, forcing it, and then just let go. But the one I do recommend, the letting go, is the Ananda method of enlightenment, which is very safe and which many of you are already pretty skilled at. The Ananda method of enlightenment. So, the Ananda method of enlightenment. Ananda was the attendant of the Buddha for, was it 25 years? Following the Buddha around, listening to all the teachings. And imagine what it must be like. You're sitting down there and you listen to this person, oh, they got this stage of enlightenment, that stage of enlightenment. And Ananda hadn't got anything yet. He was a streamer, apparently, but nothing more. And he thought to himself, when the Buddha was about to pass away, 25 years with the greatest teacher, personal access, and I still haven't broken through to full enlightenment. What hope would there be for me once the Buddha passed away? And so he was just really quite disappointed. And it made it even worse after the Buddha passed away and Ananda still wasn't enlightened. So they decided to have this meeting, this conference, bringing all the arahats together. It was supposed to be 500. It could have been less, it could have been more. That was just the number. But they decided to invite Ananda as well. Even though he wasn't qualified by being enlightened, he still had this amazing memory and been sitting next to the Buddha for such a long time that he would have remembered many of those teachings, even though he would not have penetrated them fully with his own wisdom. He still would remember them. So they invited him. So he was to attend a conference where 499 of those attendees were fully enlightened. And he was the only one who was not. Imagine how you would feel. Imagine how you would feel. This is the seminar I usually give. If at the end of this retreat, I make the announcement that every one of you is fully enlightened except for you. Oh, that really hurts. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, it's not fair. So, shame, peer pressure, whatever you would call it. The night before the conference, Ananda decided to give it everything he got. Enlightenment or bust. And anyone who ever said, every time that people have done that, it's always been bust. There's something wrong about that. But anyway, he tried and tried and tried, and tried and tried and tried, meditated all night, never slept, came to dawn. Nothing. No improvement. So what do I do next? I've got to go to this conference. It's going to start in an hour and so. So what did he decide to do? To take a nap. You know, before the and slept all night. He was tired, exhausted, trying so hard. So he went to his room and before his head hit the pillow, he became that 500th arahat to attend the conference. He broke through. It's brilliant. And so, if you haven't become enlightened yet, try the Ananda method. And just as I said, like buying lottery tickets, the more tickets you buy, the greater the chance. So a nap in the morning, nap before lunch. No, don't do that. But why did that happen? Because he totally let go. He stopped searching for things. And those things come to you. So Ajahn Chah, sitting down, being still, that's the hardest thing to do in life, to do nothing. It's not easy to sit here and be still. Opening your hand. To me, that I understand that's compassion, kindness. Open the door of your heart to whatever's happening right now. Just being here. Now, the reason why this works is this, how I describe this. It comes from, again, that time when I was a student going to any meditation course, retreat I could find without the luxury to choose a teacher or the method. If it was a retreat on, I would go. And this was only a weekend retreat, and it was at a Zen retreat north of England in a place called Throstle Hole, a long time ago, Kenneth Roshi's Shasta Abbey group. So it was the first time I'd done a full-on Zen retreat. And so I didn't really know what to expect. But I was told to, like the people on retreat, we'd sit in this converted barn with benches facing a whitewashed wall. I was told to actually to sit there and just with your eyes open and just stare at the wall, basically. I think about 45 minutes, and then we do some walking, then back and sit for 45 minutes. And that was just the routine. It was helpful that I've done some meditation before, some breath meditation. At least I knew how to be in the moment and be silent. That helped, because there I was, just sitting there, just staring at a whitewashed wall, not fantasizing, not planning, not writing a novel about my experience, just being still, being quiet. And then the wall vanished. It disappeared. I wasn't afraid at that time, because this was the late 60s, early 70s, you know, when weird stuff was fashionable. It was the era of psychedelia, of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, LSD. And all that. I never got involved in that, I was very fortunate, but still I was exposed to all this weird stuff which people reported. And there I was in a retreat, looking at a whitewashed wall, and it totally vanished. And I just, why? Gain the experiences, first of all. Don't disturb the experiences. When you're doing meditation, if something interesting happens, be quiet. Like, as a scientist, gather the data and don't make any conclusions till all the data is in. Otherwise, you'll actually disturb the data gathering process. So, I just was there, weird, pause, waiting. And when the wall came back again, then I started exploring, contemplating what happened. How can a wall just suddenly disappear from existence? Then, quite easy to understand. Because I also noticed that when I meditate with my eyes closed, it's mindful enough that when I first close my eyes, I can see the inside of my eyelids. How long for? Few seconds, and then it vanishes. Why? Can you hear the sound of, is that the aircon or is it the electricity? There's a hum in the background. After a while you won't be able to hear it anymore. When things remain static, they don't change. They disappear. The brain and the senses has so evolved to such efficiency that it only notices changes in phenomena. If something's always there, it disappears. Inside of my eyelids, see them now, a few moments, if I keep my eyes closed, they're not important, the brain will turn off. It's so similar these days, and again, it's a metaphor I use, is your computer. If you don't touch anything, you don't click the mouse or press anything, first of all, your computer goes into the screensaver and then it just turns off, it goes blank. That's what happens to your brain. That's how it's wired, only to see changes. It is why the taste of your saliva, you can't taste it, because it's the same. Sounds in the background. You don't have to have a totally silent place to meditate. Even if it is close to a road, as long as no one honks their horns, as long as it's ambient sound, it's the same, you don't hear it anymore. And this is what happens, the idea of disappearance, which is one of the most important ideas of meditation. If you are going to be aware of, say, your breathing, all these other distractions have to disappear first. Otherwise you're aware of your breath and then you hear a sound or an itch on your head or mosquito biting. So, how do you do this? You calm, first of all, the sound has to be calmed, and that's one of the most difficult things to let go and to turn off. Sight is very easy to turn off. Just close your eyes and after a while you don't see anything. See if you can notice that next time you meditate. Closing your eyes and after a few minutes you can't see anything. In fact, the sense of sight is not working anymore. It's turned off. Great efficiency. Smells, that's one of the reasons why they used to have incense in the temples. Because, you know, people were stinky, smelly. You didn't sort of have so much good hygiene. And even today, here comes a gross joke just to make things easy. I can't be serious for too long. As long as people don't eat too many baked beans, then the smell of the hall doesn't change. And if you do have bad digestion, that's why, out of compassion, we ask all the people who pass wind regularly to sit in the back. Not in the front, because if you sit in the front, say like Claire here, if she passed wind, then it will go to everybody behind. But if she sat in the back, it's just the wall gets it. Which means that we all know why the people who sit in the back are sitting there. Okay, that's a gross Ajahn Brahm. I got that out of the way now, out of my system. But a smell turns off pretty easily. Taste turns off pretty easily. The two things which are hard to turn off of your five senses are sound and physical feeling. Years ago, first came to Perth, 36 years ago, that I was with this other monk, Ajahn Jacaro, and we had an invitation. A gentleman had just brought the first flotation tank into Western Australia. Now, the sensory deprivation tanks, he described it to us. It was like full of salt water at your body density, so you just float in it. And it's body temperature, it's warm. So you don't feel cold, you don't feel heat, you don't feel any pressure on any part of your body at all. No sore bottom, no sore legs, no sore back. You're just floating there, totally relaxed. And it was like a chamber there, so it was dark, no light could get in, so the light had been turned off. And it must have had some ventilation there somewhere, I don't know how that worked, but it's all your five senses could actually be let go of. And I asked him afterwards, what was it like? You must have got jhana so easy in there, just no distractions. And what he said, yeah, it was really great in there, just no physical feelings at all, because the physical feelings, the temperature was the same, not cold, not hot, fully supported by the water, just no pressure on any part of your body, and no sound, no light. But he said there was a sound. His breathing. Because when everything else was turned off, that was what was left, the breath. And because There was nothing else to pay attention to. That breath was just so prominent. And that answered a lot of questions for me. One unfortunate event which happened next was the following morning. Some of our disciples came up to us and they told me that you can't go there. I was to go that afternoon. I was the next in line. They said, sorry, you can't go. Why not? Because we've been scammed. There was an advertisement in the paper. Flotation tanks, as used by senior Buddhist monks for the they just got us. We couldn't argue with it because we did go in there. But that was for free. Never told us it was, you know, to advertise his product. So I asked, well, the damage has been done now. Can I go? Please, 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 please. No. But it was, I obviously trusted him, a really good friend. But it opened up a lot of understanding of what meditation is. Why did the Buddha say so much about the breath meditation? Not the heart meditation. Why the breath? And the point is, when everything else is still, there's hardly any sound, so you don't pay attention to sound. There's nothing to pay attention to. When your eyes are closed and the sight turns off, when you learn how to sit in a reasonably comfortable meditation posture, on a chair is fine, it doesn't matter. Even meditating on your bed if you're sick, or even if you just, everything else is aching, just lay on your bed. That's one of the meditation postures, the four postures on the bed. But I'll just mention here, if it is on the bed, do not meditate in the same posture where you go to sleep. So because I've been a monk a long time now, I always go to sleep on my right side. But when I meditate on a bed, I always lay on my back. And I've trained myself over 45 years of being a monk, I never go to sleep laying on my back. It's as if psychologically my brain thinks, he's on the back, that's not sleep time. On the side, that's sleep time. And so that psychologically, that if I want to meditate and just relax, I lay on my back, don't go to sleep. So if you can find a posture, if you want to do laying down meditation, where you don't usually fall asleep, and reserve that posture, whether it's on your left side, right side, on your tummy, on back or whatever, reserve that posture for your meditation. That's the awareness posture, not the sleep posture. So anyway, you find a good posture so the body doesn't give you any aches and pains. And I was surprised, especially reading the monastic rules, all these rules we have to keep. One of those rules is, we're not supposed to indulge in lighting a fire for warmth. Like a campfire, where we tell ghost stories to one another, or just sing songs. But they said, and this was in the commentaries, if you light a fire so your body is healthy and comfortable for meditation, yes. It was anything to make your body at ease to be able to meditate, yes. And when I was a young monk reading that, I thought, wow, this meditation does depend upon bodily ease and comfort enough that the body can disappear, can vanish. Just like my sight vanished when I was looking. Soon your body disappears. And your body is never as comfortable as when it vanishes. I think you can see many people in this room. No, I'm just describing honestly that people are moving their legs, they're scratching their arm, they are just moving their fingers, they are scratching their chin, they are moving their legs again over there. That we're always moving. Have a look and just watch how many people can be perfectly still. Scratching your cheek. We do this so often in your head. We do this so often, we don't even notice it anymore. Moving your legs. I'll stop it. You can see how much, scratching your hair, two people. Don't be embarrassed about it or ashamed. But why do people do that? It's because your body is notoriously demanding of your attention. It's never really comfortable. And so to be able to actually to sit without needing to scratch, to move, to adjust, it's like you're free of this demanding person, always wanting something. Never satisfied, maybe for a second or two, and then they want something else. This body. But when it's still and vanishes, it's so free, peaceful, a great irritation has been taken away from you. But it's hard to do, so we try and get some comfort as best we can. But there are times when you are not aware of your body. Many times, I don't mean just in sleep. The other time when a lot of your body is distant from you is when you're watching the TV, a movie, or a sports match. It's amazing when people are meditating, they complain, their legs go to sleep, they've got sore knees. But when you're watching a football match or a movie for a couple of hours, you can't feel your legs. And only afterwards, oh, when the match finishes, your legs have gone to sleep, but while you're actually watching it, even sound. What was that Malaysian couple living in Perth? They told me that they were watching this movie. It must have been a great movie. And when the movie finished, one went up to go to the toilet, the other one to make a cup of tea, turn the water heater on the kettle. It's only when they got up, when they looked behind, their sofa just a foot behind. There was many things missing from the shelves, expensive things. The burglar had been in the house, honestly, no exaggeration, right behind their sofa. While they were watching the movie, the burglar was helping himself to whatever. And they never heard a thing. And I said, if only you could do that when you were meditating. So the sound, things are disappeared. So with stillness, keeping things still, things start to disappear. Now with your body, that's one of the reasons why I think 2 days ago I mentioned the first part of the meditation is to actually to really learn how to relax your own body. And that's just a beautiful thing to be able to do. Body awareness. Kaya Gata Sati. What do we mean by that? You be aware of the body and learn how it works and learn how to relax it so it disappears. How do you relax that body? Sometimes you get a pain, say in the knee or stomachache. So you are aware of it. And then you see how it develops. Because you notice every experience, every feeling in the body will always change. It never stays the same. Often it gets worse. Sometimes it throbs. Sometimes it just gets less. And with the Satipatthana, it's not just seeing the arise and fall. It's seeing the cause, why these things happen. You find out what relaxes that tension, and what makes it worse, the cause and effect. And when you know how this works, after a while, you get a sense of being able to work with and overcome these aches and pains in the body. Classic story, one monk, he had lots of pain when he sat in his back. Went to the doctor, had a CT scan, found out it was congenital deformity in his spine. Couldn't operate. All the doctor said is, well, you know, just don't meditate. He said, I'm a monk. That's like telling a chef not to taste the food. So he was really in big trouble. there he was, liking meditation, but every time he meditated, his back got very painful because of something which he was born with. So what did he do? He found this book, and it was teaching him what now we'd call like mindfulness and kindness, kindfulness. I think I wrote this story in the book, Kindfulness. And he was told that on either side of the spine, there are muscles which none of us are really aware of, because we don't need to be. There's so much of our body we don't need to be aware of, because it's just all automatic. Your pancreas, your liver, it's only if something's wrong you get the warning signs, but most of the time it just does its thing. So, he was told exactly where those muscles were, and to, with his hand, to stroke them, stroke those muscles. Half an hour each side or something, every morning, that was his exercise. And when he stroked them, in science we call it making a neural connection. And so when he stroked them, every time he touched them, mindfully, carefully, the brain started to make that connection until he could feel those muscles without needing to touch them. Just like I can feel my nose now, I can feel my feet now without needing to touch them. I've got a connection there like we all have. So after connecting with those muscles, the next thing he had to do was learn how to exercise them, to stretch them and relax them, stretch them and relax them, stretch them and relax them. I remember as a kid you saw these like bodybuilders, and they can get these muscles and roll them around. It was really gross. And of course, I tried to do that for 1 minute. No way I could do that. That takes a lot of training to be able to feel those muscles. And after a while, you figure out how it is, what you need to do to move them this way. Trial and error, mostly. So this monk, trial and error, until he could stretch those muscles at will. Just the way that, you know, I move my arm up, he can stretch those muscles. So he'd exercise them every morning. Stretching exercises, muscles. On that side and the other side. Until those muscles, because of exercise, became so strong, they compensated for the weakness in his spine. The problem was solved. If you have, this is my tummy ache, what's it called? Food poisoning story. Food poisoning. It's what, in monastic life, we call an occupational hazard. Because we don't cook the food, we don't see what you put in it, and sometimes it's something which disagrees with us. We try and be careful. And it's not that people don't care about us, they're not trying to poison us on purpose, but you know, sometimes it happens. So, I was in my cave with food poisoning. Ah! You should know that's coming. You've heard that story how many times? Ah! I usually give this story when people are very tired late in the evening when they go to sleep. Ah! It certainly wakes people up and you get people's attention. Ah! That's what it was like. And if you had like very painful stomach cramps, you know, you can't resist it. It's nature. You know, ah! So there I was going, ah, 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 but not that quickly in my cave. No one could hear me, obviously. That's why I got the cave over there. So two doors so I could actually be quiet. So I can't hear what's going on outside. But it also means you can't hear what's going on inside either. So I'm stuffed. If I'm really in trouble, then that's where I die. That's fine. It's a nice place. Got my mausoleum, my cave. You can just leave me in there. Just lock the door and say he's dead. Well, you've got to get buried in. You're already buried in the cave. Why take you out of the cave and bury you somewhere else? In a small box, which is expensive and nowhere near as comfortable as my cave. So please leave me in my cave when I die, okay? So it's very efficient. So there you are in the cave. Ah! And then, so what do you do? All these teachings of meditation you give other people, and how about practicing them yourself, which you do? So, there was the pain. You see, this unendurable just contraction, which was just so fiery pain which you couldn't resist. So you just started to watch it. And the key is always kindness. Compassion, kindness is such an important part of the Dhamma. So I was kind to my muscles, which were contracting. Really kind to them. It's okay, muscles, you can contract if you want. Just that little bit of kindness meant their contraction was a little bit slower, less intense, less painful. The pain reduced by maybe 0.5%. Just like that story about doubt, I was going in the correct direction. Water was going downhill. So I continued. Just be kind. Continued, relaxing. It was relaxing. I could feel the muscles getting less and less tight. Much of pain is caused by fear. You tense up even worse than you really need to. It's an overreaction of the body. So, relax, relax, relax. And I could feel every contraction was less intense, less painful. Until there was 20 minutes, half an hour, about that time, then no more food poisoning. No more pain. Stomach back to really comfortable abiding. And I was just, hey, this is really good stuff, this meditation. You don't have to go to the hospital and get injected and get this test and that test. It will keep you overnight just in case and come back tomorrow morning, try this drug, that drug, and all other sorts of drugs. 20 minutes, and it was gone. But to this day, I just can't figure out, you know, just biologically what was happening. Because these are bacteria multiplying in your gut and creating havoc. Until I started to get some, maybe, sort of some hypothesis, some theory of what must have gone on in my gut. All these bacteria fighting and causing inflammation and the body just reacting with contractions. I imagine that all these bacteria, because I always imagine them as little blobs with little tentacles coming off them. And I imagine all these little blobs, their tentacles all crossed in meditation, all meditating quietly in my gut. That's how I visualized it. I thought that was really cool. Probably nowhere near the truth, but it's a nice way to visualize even little bacteria just getting in on the in the act and just meditating as well. So they just pass calmly through my system without causing any more problems. The meditating bugs. Anyway, so that's where you learn about how the body works, so you can relax it, become peaceful from the great pain of the cramps of food poisoning to a very calm, peaceful body. And it disappears. Sometimes people have difficulty sleeping at night. Feel the body. Relax it. And if you learn about your body and how to relax the body, soon the body disappears. And if you're not wanting to meditate that night, but you just wanting to have a nice night's sleep, you relax the body until the body vanishes and then you're fast asleep. Have a good night's sleep too, relaxed. You've got some understanding of how your body works. So, the body disappears. Sound, not paying any attention to. So the only thing left, the breath. You don't focus on the breath, you let everything else go. So you may have the Buddha statue in the middle of the room. You don't focus on the Buddha statue, you just put everything else aside. Let go of everything else. Until that Buddha statue is the only thing left. It's focusing, but not by force, by letting go of all the other distractions. What sometimes they say, getting everything else out of the way, so that's the only thing left. Getting the body out of the way, getting the thoughts especially out of the way, getting the past and future out of the way, getting And so the only thing left, the only thing left to see is the breathing. It's the only thing left which is moving, like in the tank. So, many times when I was starting meditating on the breath, I would go looking for the breath, capture it. As soon as I captured it, I've got to hold on to this breath. It's really important. Okay, breathing in, breathing out. Stay where you are. You're about to go. Staying in. And it was so tense. And soon my breath would find a chink in the armor and escape somewhere. It was like being a prisoner being held in this jail and always looking for a way to escape my breath from my sort of controlling mind. Yeah, you could watch the breath for a while, but it was just so tiring. And you missed out the happiness and the joy in meditation, which people kept on talking about. But then, what happened? You decided to just let go. You have to, letting go means really letting go, not playing around. Sit still, find out, where does this happen, and just let it go until aches and pains just disappear. Go right through your body. And I should say, there's so many good side effects to this. There are times when, you know, people have cancers and you can catch it before even the machine catches it. You know, scanning through your body, you get somewhere. You can feel there's something which is, how do you explain it? It's not balanced, it's not right, it's just there's something wrong there because you're aware enough to catch the fact the body's telling you there's some tightness there, there's some tension there. And oh, great success with this, with breast cancers. It's a really scary thing, because I forget how many, a really significant percentage of women will have breast cancer in their life. It's not pleasant. So you're just focusing in, you can feel there's something which is imbalanced there. Don't say what it is, don't try and explain it, give it words, because sometimes you can't put these things into words. But then you actually can feel it and you can start to, what do I need to do to actually bring that back to a balance, to a healthy balance? Because I don't know exactly what health means or balance means, but I know it. This is healthy, this is not. And then you just, a lot of times with that kindness, letting it be, start to relax. And then at the end of the meditation, you feel good now. This is how, you know, people's tumours and stuff start to disappear. How they catch them so early. Because, you know, it's your body. You've been with your body for a long time. You should be able to know it by now. Know when things are going well and that things are not going well. So that's actually how you deal with some of these problems. What was that other case recently? Over in Korea, South Korea, going for the big event there, and in the mountains, really cold, and of course, you know, just I got a cold. You know, it was just at the wrong time. It was about an hour. I started sneezing, and the snot started coming out of my nose, and didn't have any medication because it was unexpected. And in 1 hour's time, I had to go on the TV for an interview. Imagine going on a TV with snot coming down your nose. That's not a very good impression. In fact, they'll probably take you off and cancel it or something. So, half an hour, come on. So, you feel the irritation in your top of your sinus. You can feel the imbalance and the stuff coming out. It's just an overreaction of the sinus, whatever it is. You feel it. And then just, what makes it better, what makes it worse? No fear, but using your kindness and mindfulness together. And it worked. So after half an hour, don't know where that cold went to, but anyway, I can give the interview, no problem at all. So, this is what the sort of tricks which monks do. It's nothing supernatural. What it is using your mindfulness and kindness, your body awareness, to calm the body down. So if you're giving an interview or giving a talk, or you want to just watch the breath, that's the last thing which is left, the breath. And that's what you're aware of. And when I go looking for the breath, I can watch the breath now, breathing in. But it's like I'm forcing it, rushing to the breath. When I let everything else go, until the only thing I'm aware of is the breath, then it is always very delightful. It's peaceful, it's relaxed. Because I haven't gone to catch it. It's almost like it's come to me. Imagine that I told you, you, come to my interview now. Of course, you'd be tense. Just like if I get the breath, you come over here. But if you relax, then that's the last thing you're with the breath. You're peaceful. And the breath comes to you. So, wonderful living in the forest, living here in, even in Jhana Grove. Years ago, you can go for walks in the forest. Years ago, there was many emus here. Since we built over here, then the emus went further into the forest. But one of the Anagarikas once, he was meditating, you know, just much, much closer, about between here and monastery, about two-thirds of the way to the monastery. Much closer to the monastery than here, just meditating in the bush, sitting down quietly, nice day. And this emu, and emus are just usually really, really skittish, terrified of human beings. They're big, big fellows, emus. And this emu, so seeing this monk, oh, it's actually Anagarika in white, sitting perfectly still there, came right up to the Anagarika and sniffed him. What is this? And no, he was wise enough just to be, he had his eyes open by this time, wise enough just to be perfectly still. So the emu could sniff him and was not at all scared, and just very calmly just walked away. It's such a beautiful thing with animals who, you know, they're wild, they're not tame, they're not pets, totally not scared of you. So they come to you. The breath comes to you. And when the breath comes to you, you don't hold it, you don't disturb it. And it stays with you. And that's when it comes so delightful. Total relaxation. No effort, no fear, no tightness. Totally relaxed with the breathing. And what happens next? We'll be told tomorrow. I've actually got onto the breath in breath meditation. But on purpose, because people rush too fast onto the breath. Take it slowly. When the breath comes to you and you work with it, then, whoa, all that preparation was more than worth it. Sadhu. 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 Very good. So we have some interviews now, and then we have the usual program in the afternoon.